Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everyone. Happy Monday. Thanks for joining us. I'm Stephen Long, author of There's a Somebody. If you have read the book, if you care to read the book, or want to talk with me, you can go to my website, stephenwlong.com, or follow on the Facebook page, There's a Somebody. Today I'm going to be talking with Lisa Olin Harris, who has written two memoirs, Through the Veil and the fifth season, A Daughter-in-Law's Memoir of Caregiving. So good morning, Lisa.
Hi, Steve. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Well, thanks for agreeing to do that. I've been following your activity, and you have been a busy woman. So tell us what's been going on in your life.
Somewhat busy, yes. Well, my second book, the fifth season, released in September. And I've done, you know, a fair amount of traveling, not a lot, but it's always really fun and really personal and great to meet people. And this is a book about the years that my mother-in-law shared a household with my husband, myself, and our four daughters. And, of course, at the end of those years, the end of her life, she grew frail and needed help, and we were there to help her. So we kind of lived through that really difficult season at the end of life when you're not sure whether to pursue medical treatment for even really routine conditions or not.
Sure.
And so some of what I talk about in the book certainly is the frustrations and somewhat the joys, but more the frustrations of an intergenerational household, but especially the caregiving and end-of-life things. And as I've traveled and met with book groups and church groups and done some speaking, everybody who comes up to talk to me has their own story. And I have been enriched by talking with people. I've learned a lot. And it feels like there's this whole sort of under-the-surface collection of stories that we have about our loved ones, about end-of-life issues, but it's not something that you just talk about at a Thanksgiving gathering, you know, or after church on a Sunday or something. But having written this book and speaking about these issues opens that up so that we can tell our stories, and those who don't have stories then, I hope, can think ahead, because even though I've walked this path now once with my mother-in-law, I know it's ahead of me also with my own parents, with my husband. Who knows, you know, what the future holds.
Sure.
The one thing we do know about the future is every one of us will die, and we don't know how or when. But to shut our eyes to that, I think we really do a disservice to life when we shut our eyes to death and pretend like it won't happen or don't think about those issues ahead of time.
I think other cultures have handled that better. I know I've heard that Americans feel that death is some sort of failure. And in other cultures, in other times, I think it was, I don't know, maybe more unavoidable, or the contact. In other words, they didn't ship somebody off to the hospital.
If they
were in the home, and you that was part of life, was dealing with the passing.
Sure. So, well, don't you think some of it is simply that we have such a high degree of medical technology that we have something we could do? You know, 100, 200, 500 years ago, we could call somebody in, we could try something herbal or, you know, whatever we had, but you're a lot closer to death when you have less ways that you can pretend it doesn't exist. And what you say about we want to pretend there's always something we can do, or we want to distance ourselves from it, that's really what's going on, I think, in medical education also, is that doctors are not trained for end-of-life issues so much as they're trained there's always a next thing you can try. You can do this, and that death is, as you say, a failure of the physician rather than inevitable. And not that the physicians should just wash their hands of it, but we also need guidance through the end of lifetimes. And at the end of my mother-in-law's life, we didn't realize she was at the end. And we were really afraid that we would be, in essence, pushing her into the coffin if we brought up any talk of hospice, which, in fact, we did bring up a couple of times with two different doctors, a specialist and her primary care physician, and both of them said, oh, no, no, we're not ready to cross that bridge yet, when actually we were ready to cross that bridge. But what we needed was some guidance and some help to make those decisions. And a lot of people, myself included, think that hospice is a last-ditch thing. When you can't do anything else, you finally throw up your hands and you let the hospice take you away. Well, first of all, hospice doesn't need to take you away. My mother-in-law stayed right in our home with us in her own, well, in a hospital bed, but a hospital bed in the place where her own bed had been.
Sure.
And we had nurses come in to care for her. She didn't have to run to the doctor or to the hospital for sort of routine care like she had been before. And if she had wanted to go ahead and receive a more dramatic treatment, she could have done so. Depending on what the treatment was, she could have done that on hospice, or she could have left hospice and been admitted to a hospital for treatment. So it's not like, you know, you sign the paper and you're definitely going to die, or if you don't die in 6 months, they kick you off or something. But what we didn't realize until it was really too late was that hospice exists to provide a space and a rest to allow people to complete the unfinished business of life. And instead of running around to doctors and being poked and prodded and squeezed and hooked up to machines, to be able to get your financial affairs in order, get your spiritual affairs in order, get your relationships in order, and just spend time. You know, there was time that my mother-in-law could have been spending with her grandkids that she spent in a doctor's office waiting room with her grandchild, you know, fussy and irritable because we'd been there so long. If we'd known she could have been resting at home, the nurses could have come to her for that same treatment, and she could have enjoyed reading to her granddaughter during those hours, you know, instead of that being a frustrating time. So it's really my deal for those of us who've experienced this to be able to, you know, offer testimonial of what we've been through, and together to sort of take hands and walk through these times. And I think there are changes going on in the medical establishment. People understand more. But when we're afraid to cross that bridge before we come to it, all of a sudden we're stumbling over the bridge instead of thinking about it ahead of time and preparing for when it's time to cross that bridge.
You know, I heard somebody the other day talk about their baby and that you don't get an owner's manual with the baby. Well, you know what? Yeah. You don't get an owner's manual on the other end either. And one of the reasons I think your book is so valuable is the inevitability. I mean, even if you think birth before the fact is not inevitable, but once you are born, then death is inevitable. So at that point, we're all going to experience in one way or another what you've described. And I think that there are individual approaches. And what I'm thinking about is, I read your book, of course, and I just thought it was terrific. But Jean seemed to, as I understood this, and Jean being your mother-in-law, accepted her fate at some point. It wasn't early on, but at some point she did. And having gone through this with my parents, both my parents, but particularly my mother, she, for a long, long time, would not accept it, and I think it made the transition more difficult.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And so those of us who are not the patient, we are walking this kind of fine line, or walking so gently trying to discern how much do we speak truth when we know it. You know, if we know there's nothing that can be done, how much do we gently press and say, you know, nothing can be done, Mom, because we don't want to live in a culture that pushes people to death.
Of course.
At all. When we were just on the cusp of the decision to receive hospice care, Jeannie called her sons and her grandkids together, and we had a nice dinner together around the table, and then she let us know. And, of course, the adults already knew what was going on. But even that night when she had called us together to let us know she had decided to go on hospice, she said, "I don't want you all to think that I'm afraid or that I'm not brave enough." And then she started to have sort of what seemed like second thoughts even then. She said, maybe I should go ahead and, I don't want to go into detail, not having read the book together right now on air, but maybe I should go ahead and do this procedure, which was, you know, an invasive procedure that was sure to leave her in discomfort she was just not willing to endure, and probably for no good. And so as the daughter-in-law at that moment, I felt like, no, 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 Mom, we want you to rest. We want to rest. We don't want to make this misery longer. And yet, at that moment, I knew, I can't say this. I'm the daughter-in-law. I'm the caregiver. I can't say, we'd really like you to just die, Mom. I can't say this. But her son, who had been widowed as a young man in his 40s, he said, Mom, you don't want to go into the hospital because here's what's going to happen. You're going to get hooked up to machines and you're going to want to come home to die, and it's going to take a long time for us to be able to get the paperwork done and to convince the hospital or whatever that you really do want to come home or to get you home. It's really hard to get unhooked from the machines once you're hooked up. And he was able to say to her, no, I don't think in a way that was pushing her because he discerned what she really did want, but he was able to give her confidence that, no, we don't think you're a chicken. We don't think you're not being brave enough. And there is always, I think, we want a hope that maybe this treatment will do it, and certainly a lot of the way, in my experience, that physicians communicate a potential treatment makes it sound like there's sometimes a lot better chance of success than there really is. And they don't know, and we don't know either. So, yeah, I guess it's not just, you know, this what this journey is and knowing the right answers or knowing the prognoses, but it's also knowing the person, knowing that loved one, and being in a close enough relationship that you can, to some degree, discern what they want, but also, I think, speak with confidence about what you feel would be best. And that is really hard. Really hard.
Well, that's what the takeaway for me was what I'm about to address, and that is in both of your books, I was impressed with two things. Your skill as a writer, but beyond that, your honesty. And you did not sugarcoat your feelings. When you talk about wanting somebody to die, I think anybody in that situation, none of us are Mother Teresa. Maybe Mother Teresa didn't feel this either. At some point, you know the inevitable, and you have a life too. And you talked about what opportunities are your children missing, or what are you and Todd missing with your children because you put the rest of your life on hold. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Sure. Well, I was in a kind of a younger caregiver position than many of us are. How old were you? Asking how old you were, but were your kids out of the house by the time your mom was in decline and you were walking this road with her?
Actually, you know, it's interesting. Literally out of the house, yes, in the sense that they didn't live with us, but both my daughters at some point took turns being with my mom at the early stages when she could live with assistance, you know, live independently, but with, you know, somebody there. And we transitioned from my wife being the primary caregiver. Well, I guess she really always was. But then each of my daughters took a turn living with my mother. And so, yes, they were literally out of the house, but we were all very close in this process.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like they were young women, and generally you think of sort of launching them out into the beginning of their lives, and here they are caring for an old woman. But actually, how beautiful is that? How wonderful is that? Another thing that, you know, caregivers need to know, there's an end to this too. It is a season. And for some, it's a longer season than others. So even though, because my feeling was my kids, I can't be in their classroom. I had a preschooler and three grade school kids when I was caring for my mother-in-law. And I couldn't go on field trips like the other moms. And I'm kind of not the kind of mom that does a lot of that anyway. But I couldn't do these things that the other moms were doing. And my kids sort of noticed, but not a lot because that's what their life was. But
right.
I couldn't go camping with the family. You know, my husband took the girls camping, and I stayed home taking care of Jeannie. And, yes, I resented that, absolutely. And it was hard. But at the same time, someone needs to do it. We need to take care of our elderly. You know,
mm-hmm.
we just said not too long ago, we don't want to be in a society that tells people when they're going to die or decides for them. And
right.
so it was a good thing. But a hard thing, and both of those can, you know, coexist. I can't. My story
oh,
isn't
sure.
a story of great blessing and joy and bliss through this, because that was not my experience. But with this distance now of 5 years since her death, I'm glad we did it. But I'm also
mm-hmm.
really glad it's over.
Sure.
So my husband had said along the way to me more than once, you know, this is really good for our girls to see, and. My daughters, for the most part, are not afraid of old people. They're not afraid of a wheelchair or
mm-hmm.
an oxygen tank. They're still as afraid of needles as anyone is, but they're not afraid
sure.
to touch disability or decline. And I'm really happy about that, and I know that that's a direct result of having these medical accoutrements as part of our household for so many years. And Jeannie could be hooked up to tubes and wires and whatnot in the hospital, and the girls would climb right up on the bed with her and snuggle with her.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really happy for that for them, even though it was hard and our life revolved around her care. I think it was good, and I hope it built my girls' character in some good ways. Although, when I think ahead to my own decline and my husband's, boy, I sure don't want to put them in the position that I was in. And yet, what if they want to be in that position? What if they want to take care of us? Can we be humble enough to receive
mm-hmm.
that graciously instead of irritably, which is also some of the problem in a caregiving situation when the person who's receiving care has a hard time receiving care, which we understand because we're independent. We've always taken care of ourselves. And then the time comes to receive that care. It's really hard to do that graciously.
I think often it's easier to give help than receive help.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless
sure.
of what that is, and if we were in a barn-raising society, it might be more more difficult to have somebody come over to your place and help you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me a little bit about your earlier book, Through the Veil. That
mm-hmm.
that was my first exposure. A similar writing style, and again, completely honest, which I just was fascinated with. But talk a little bit about Through the Veil.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was a young woman in my 20s, I went on a research project in the Middle East, actually in Damascus, Syria. And this was, of course, long before the war and even before the first Gulf War, so before there was as much turmoil in the Middle East as there is now. And while I was on that project, I was in Muslim homes every day. We were doing ethnographic research, which means we were conducting sort of anthropological research, talking to people on the street to try to determine what were the ethnic groupings in the city and how were these groupings separate socially and even religiously. And so I was out on the street every day with another young woman as my partner asking, do you speak English? Do you speak English? And when we found someone who
sure.
spoke English, we would ask what their ethnicity was. Were they Palestinian, Syrian, Circassian? However many people groups were there, we learned through this research. And because Muslim culture is so hospitable, we were asked into homes every day. We ate almost
mm-hmm.
every lunch we ate in a Muslim home. And then there were informants, which is, you know, the people that I'm researching are giving me information, but informants become friends. And we would go back and visit some of these same women, mostly women interviewing women on our team and men interviewing men because of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so Through the Veil is really a book about my experience in the Middle East. And the first part of the book is about my experience as a single woman in Damascus on this ethnographic research project, where I happened to meet my husband, Todd, who's an American. And we came back to the U.S., got married, went to graduate school, and then returned to Amman, Jordan, when our eldest daughter was about a year old, had two more kids in Jordan. My husband was the pastor of an expatriate church there. And so the second half of the book is about my experience in Amman, Jordan, being a mother and having raising a family in a Muslim culture. And really, as you know, Steve, from reading it, but this book is structured in kind of independent chapters, almost the way that a novel in short stories would be structured. This might be a memoir in essays. So when you meet Mesa in one of the first chapters and you hear Mesa's story, you don't meet Mesa again. You move on to another Muslim woman's story. And I'm a constant throughout. And, of course, once you meet my husband and my kids, they reappear throughout the story. But the Muslim women you meet in the book really don't reappear very much, which is kind of what my experience was like, you know, doing the research.
Sure.
And then my Muslim friendships, even in Jordan, would be sometimes brief and not recurring. So that book was really the book that I learned to write from, I say.
Mm-hmm.
But I was fortunate enough that it was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award in 2011, which was a wonderful affirmation to me as a, perhaps not a young writer, but an emerging writer at that point.
Sure.
And encouraged me to continue writing, you know, which of course I have done and continue to do. And I'll often say, I figure out what I think about things by writing down what I think and working it out on paper. And that's really what my books do. So there are a lot of issues about Islam and about cross-cultural experience in Middle Eastern culture that I work out on the page in Through the Veil, just as the caregiving issues on many different planes are worked out on the page in the fifth season. And the reader is invited to enter into that thought process along with me and hopefully work out her own thought process as she reads as well.
Sure. Well, I think it's no surprise that writing down those thoughts, whoever you are, is a therapy. And there's a fella in town here who suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. And my understanding is that here his doctor had pretty much run through all of the things that he could think of to help. And in the end he said, well, why don't you just write this?
Wow.
And over some period of time the fella did, it became a fairly successful book. And guess what? When he got through with the book, he stopped having these horrible nightmares.
Wow,
so
if
this isn't too convoluted, it is a process of processing.
It is. It is therapy on the page with yourself as your therapist, I think, and your research as your therapist. Yeah, that's really true.
You said something just now that struck me. You talked about affirmation. And when I published my book, people didn't use these words, but really what they said was, why did you do this or what are you after? And for me, it was affirmation. It was that that I had some talent at something, that I could do something well. And it's been just such a rewarding experience. And in any case, I'm happy that both you and I did that.
Yeah, and you with your book, Steve, you've contributed to the literary culture, and certainly in our geographical area you've contributed, which is a lovely thing. It's not entirely about self-affirmation. It's also about offering something worthy and even beautiful to our culture. And for you and for me, that's directly to our culture here in the Willamette Valley that we offer those pieces of work.
Sure. I've had a couple of more than a couple, honestly, but some positive comments. Thank you for writing this book. I never looked at that situation in that light before. One mother came to me and said that when she finished the book, she cried because she, up to that point, had thought she was a bad mother because her son just couldn't commit in a relationship. And after reading my book, she thought that, you know, maybe it wasn't me. Maybe that's just sometimes how guys are. So yeah. That was unexpected. I wrote the book really as entertainment, not as any kind of a psychological treatise or anything. But
it
was nice to hear that.
Yeah, and that's why it works, is that you're not trying to preach. You don't have an agenda. And yet the emotions and the self-doubt and inabilities, all of those are authentic in your protagonist. And so they're real, and that's why it speaks to people, which is really great.
I remember a quote that's attributed to, I think it's Jack Warner, who told one of his screenwriters, if you want to send a message, deliver a telegram. In other words, don't get preachy.
Right.
This is entertainment.
Yeah.
Entertain. Don't try to convert somebody.
Yeah. Sure.
So I wanted to pursue something else here a little bit. Two things. My understanding is you're a teacher.
I am.
And then tell me a little about that. That's at George Fox. Is that correct?
Yeah, I actually teach for two universities, Steve. I don't know if you know this. I teach English as a second language at George Fox, and I do some work with writing there as well, but it's always academic writing. Not creative writing at this point, but I teach creative writing for Southern New Hampshire University online in their Master's in Creative Writing program. I work with nonfiction there. Teaching at 4 in the morning online. I'm teaching at 10 in the morning on the ground. And love it. I love all of it. Yeah.
Well, good. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about, you and I met because of the Terroir Creative Writing Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's started up again. You've had a meeting or two. What's going on there? Anything substantive yet?
Well, the festival is going to be April 19th, 2014, and it will be, again, at the Chemeketa campus. What's the one that's in MAC called? The name of that campus?
I don't know.
The Chemeketa Satellite Campus that's in McMinnville, Oregon. And I don't think I can say who the speakers are because I'm not sure it's confirmed yet, but we have a lovely variety of speakers. Oh, I'm going to be a speaker. I can say that. That's confirmed.
Good.
And it's a great conference, and we really try to focus on local writers and local speakers coming out of the Willamette Valley, just like all these great wines. We have a lot of great art coming out of the Willamette Valley as well. And so it's a great place to meet local writers, and that's what I'm so happy about from last year, is how many of you all I met and am now friends with as I'm serving on the committee the second time. I know these people, and it's fun, and I'm able to really offer myself in a way that I couldn't last year, and I think the conference is just another example of that. I ended up getting sick the day of the conference and wasn't able to come last year. I'm really looking forward to being there this year.
Sure. Well, I hope I'm invited back. I had a lot of fun. And just in case this would interest somebody, I did a talk on crowdsource funding because that's how I funded my book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a popular topic. Of course, publishing is changing so much.
Right.
Yeah. So here I go with my little cold again. Excuse me. Well, Lisa, we're about out of time. Tell people you have both a Facebook page and a website.
I do. I'm on Facebook as Lisa Olin Harris. Olin is O-H-L-E-N. And I also have a website, which is www.lisaolenharris.com. Mm-hmm. And you can find my blog through that. You can also look for either of these books on, Powell's.com, Amazon.com. If you're in McMinnville, Third Street Books carries them. In Newburgh, where I live, both Coffee Cottage and Chapters Books has copies of the book. And if you go to my blog, you'll see what any speaking that I'm doing locally, if you're interested. But I would love to connect via any of those venues.
And you've got something in the Seattle area, I think, don't you, coming up here? Or did you do that already?
I was in the Seattle area last month, and I'll be there again next month, but not for public speaking, for a writing retreat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much. It's great to talk to you again. I'll see you at a Terroir meeting.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Steve.
Yeah. love your books. And so for anybody, particularly the fifth season, I think that's a situation, if we haven't been in, I guarantee you we will be. So pick up a copy of the fifth season. I learned a lot reading Through the Veil. And again, your honesty and just your masterful writing was a treat. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Okay,
and
bye.
Folks, again, yeah, thank you. Bye-bye. If you're interested in my book, There's a Somebody, like Lisa, it's available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores, and that, or I'd just love to hear from you. So contact me either through the website, stephenwlong.com, or the Facebook page really is more current. It's just sort of daily posts in there, and that's There's a Somebody. So I hope that you enjoyed this. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
For those born with a radarless heart, destined to wander in worried circles while others walk a truer, straighter path, I wait for you. I guide you. For those between thoughts, between breath, between life and death, I wait for you. I fill the silences for you. For those who brave the sun, brave the deoxygenated black hole dark, to write epic poems in the vast spaces between glittering stars, I wait for you, I collaborate with you. And for those who voted nihilistic and got their president of nothingness, I wait for you, I dream a better world for you. I dream a better world. Gather fractured raptures, make whole, make one. 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 Make one. For those with all the wars of the world written into the lines around their eyes, I wait for you. I bear that history with you. For those whose lives have been relegated to the B-side of that number one with a bullet track, my gunned-down life, I wait for you. I write a better song for you. For those who work the graveyard shift in the morgue melancholy, I wait for you. I work side by side with you. And for those fatal optimists, hope flourishing but cyanide on standby, I wait for you. I offer taste of faith to you. I offer taste of faith. Gather fractured raptures, make whole, make one. 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 For those with atom bombs and ghost towns encoded into their DNA, so that no matter where they go, what they do, shit just keeps blowing up and no one ever stays around for very long. I wait for you, I rebuild for you. And for those who've shipped their lives off to fictitious addresses, hoping to elude reality once and for all, I wait for you, I pick up that mail for you. And for those who speak from the heart, even when it is broken, knowing that cracked words are better than no words at all, I wait for you, yeah, I honor you. Gather fractured raptures, make whole, make one. Gather fractured raptures, make whole, make one. Gather fractured raptures, make whole, make one. Gather fractured raptures, make whole.